Hi.
Hi, Maggie. How are you?
Great. How are you?
Not too bad. Well, welcome to Stir the Pots, first
Thank
of all.
Thank you. Thank you.
And the first question I'd have to ask you, of course, is how did you start baking?
Oh, I started baking as a teenager, so a long, long, long time ago. And what I have to tell... What I have to tell my students all the time is I was a lousy baker for a really long time. But I don't know why. I just kept at it. That's really all it takes, I think.
And how did you start as a teenager baking? Was there an interest in the family? Or?
Well, it's funny. My family, I come from a family of very big cooks, and I always loved to cook. But nobody baked bread. I don't know why. Probably because I'm from Milwaukee, and you could buy really good bread there.
Yeah.
And I guess I like cooking projects. So, and bread baking really falls into that. It's kind of a project instead of let's make dinner. And it seemed like it was something that should be really easy, and then it turned out not to be so easy for me somehow.
And what were the kinds of bread that you were making?
I was doing things like oatmeal pan bread. Trying to think of a date. This was probably like late 70s, early 80s.
Right.
All those kind of typical breads. I remember trying to make a Betty Crocker orange cinnamon explosion. nothing I did was very good, I can tell you that. But nobody seemed to mind. That's the great thing about bread baking.
Yeah, I think people always appreciate the effort more than anything else.
Yeah, and the smell is so good. I mean, you can make the worst bread, and it all your house will smell so good.
You went on later to go to the AIB. Can you tell us a little bit about that organization?
Oh, yeah, they're a wonderful organization in Manhattan, Kansas, and they exist to educate. Usually, it's kind of continuing education for people already in the bread baking industry.
Uh-huh.
But I went there just kind of with a fascination for wholesale baking, but also I had done a lot of reading about cereal chemistry on my own and realized I needed proof that I really knew this stuff, so I went and sort of shored up my cereal chemistry knowledge.
And did you take a correspondence course there?
I took a correspondence course, and then to get the certification, you also have to do, at the time, I want to say, and it was a while ago, I want to say it was 4-week-long seminars there.
Uh-huh.
That was a lot of fun.
Uh-huh.
I actually really like Manhattan, Kansas. It's a really cute little town.
And is it covered with wheat? And
well, it's very weedy there. I mean, you're driving... seems like you're driving through wheat fields, although, I think it's actually pasture land, but you can imagine that it's wheat fields.
Right.
I think most of the wheat in Kansas is actually grown further south in the state.
Uh-huh.
But it's that beautiful prairie land that, every time I'd fly into Kansas City, Kansas, and then just drive into the prairie, it was always sunset, and it's very quiet, beautiful area, and there were people from all over the world and all over the country attending. We'd always have a good time. You'd go by yourself and then meet all these interesting people, and they do a really fine job of education.
I'd kind of been interested in taking the course, but I just wasn't sure what really the whole thing was about, and kind of been like wary about just, not sure how good a baker I am yet to go into something like that.
Well, when I took it, it was not geared for artisan baking. It was very much about large production, wholesale baking. I don't know if they've tweaked the courses a bit, but I don't know that you need to be such a good baker, but you have to be kind of fascinated with that side of the business.
Uh-huh.
And they do really emphasize good basics so that you really know the technical side. That's important to them. You can't fake it anymore, like a lot of bakers seem to like to.
It's interesting because I talked to Noel Kamath at Tomcat Bakery.
Right.
And seen how he had started initially when, I mean, I remember when I first came to New York and started cooking and seeing how different his operation there is now. Do you think that artisan is kind of like a misrepresentation of what bakers are doing today? Or
it's funny you should bring that. I was just thinking about it because I think I was at our local I was at a chain bakery. I don't want to name it. And they, you know, they were talking about the quote-unquote artisan bread that they're selling. And I was thinking to myself, this is not artisan bread. And it is a term that's really difficult to define. And Noel Comas in particular really pushes it. In their facility, they do hand shaping. So maybe they can cover it that way.
Yeah.
But, you know, not that there's an official, you know, definition for it, but you would think there is some craftsperson there in charge of making the bread. That should be artisan baking. It shouldn't be, you know, some large wholesale operation run out of a commissary.
Uh-huh.
But I guess if the bread is high enough quality, like at Tomcat, maybe you can stretch that definition a bit.
Yeah. And what do you think the reason is for this explosion in finding bread? I mean, you talk about traditions and stuff, and you know, American bread I think is known more for like the white wonder bread.
Right.
Loaf. And suddenly we've become these master bread bakers. And why do you think that is?
I think it goes along with, you know, our interest in food. When the bread baking movement started, that was really kind of the reawakening of the American palate. So it does go hand in hand. And I also think that people were traveling a lot more and tasting bread from Europe or any other parts of the world where they do care about bread, and going home and being sad that they couldn't eat good bread anymore. But it definitely started out in California. There's no way around that. Like, you know, a lot of the current food trends have. I believe it was in the 70s. It's been going on for a long time, but we finally gotten to the point where there's enough people around the country that are well-trained and committed that we can, you know, many Americans can now buy good artisan quality bread.
Right. Well, I'd spoken to Dan Leder as well, and we were talking about training, and I was wondering, what do you think about having like an apprenticeship system here in the States, rather than this kind of like, I don't know, I think for me, when I've been to Europe and I see the way everything is pretty much you go to school to become a baker and you're a baker for life, really.
Right.
Here it's, you know, you're a lawyer and then you become a baker.
Right. It's very interesting. Well, this is a little aside, but American bakers, professional bakers, are much, much better educated in general than European bakers, because a lot of them have gone to college and had other careers and then have gone back into baking, whereas the European bakers, they are, you know, from high school going into trade schools and then out into apprenticeships. It's really interesting, you know, when you're with a group of bakers, some from Europe, some from the United States, to see the differences. But, oh, I think an apprenticeship system in this country would just be fabulous. It would, not just for bread also. I just think it's such a shame we've gotten away from craftsmanship in all areas. One of the schools in France, in Aurillac, that I attended was it was a baking school, but it was also a craft school. And you could learn bread baking, you could learn hair cutting. You think of all the crafts that were taught there. It was really interesting, like things you wouldn't have thought of as crafts, like hair cutting. And trying to think of what else they were teaching there. There was a school for waiters and waitresses that was taught there. But we could use that here.
Yeah, because I don't think even though we're supposedly a service-oriented country, I don't think we have the refined skills, really.
No.
No.
Definitely not.
Yeah.
So what did Dan Leder think about it?
Well, we talked about a bunch of different things, and I think it was more in regard of the Bread Bakers Guild.
Uh-huh.
That he was a little bit negative about the way, you know, we had lost the school in Minnesota that they had for bread baking.
Right.
And that, you know, they teach some skills for, you know, basic things like baker's percentage and stuff, but that he felt that they're neglecting important parts of teaching people how to really run a business, you know, the nuts and bolts.
Huh.
And I've been kind of watching Gordon Ramsay's show, even though he's a bit of a nutcase. And I do respect the man because he really says, you know, if you're going to be in a business, it's not all fun and pleasure. It's really knowing every aspect. And what you don't know, you should go out and find the information to know how to run the business.
Right.
So
business side of it. Right.
Yeah. And that, for me, it's like my dream is to open a bakery, but then I always have that, like, wow, or that idea that what's going to happen if I don't really know what I'm doing.
Yeah. Well, there's a money problem.
Yeah.
There's also, for me, because I love to bake, but the successful bakers that I knew, for them, a really light, laid-back day would be 10 hours in the bakery.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I had that kind of time or stamina to ever do it professionally like that.
Uh-huh. Well, was it your intention to become a baker or to write about baking?
No, it was just to write about it. It was just like to kind of, you know, I'd just been baking at home way too much, and I thought, well, let's put some good use to all this. That's where it came from, really. I never, ever thought about opening a bakery. But after doing all these seminars and getting all this training and spending so much time with professional bakers, I was so taken with everybody I had met and taken with the business. That's when I kind of started thinking about it, but I don't think I really, not seriously.
Yeah, I've done those late night shifts after a regular shift at cooking and then going on to do little stages at bakeries, and it's pretty horrible.
Yes.
You start to forget about how wonderful and you know, what a dreamy, beautiful world bread is, because it's really torturous.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to really... Wow, it's a very physical, very difficult.
Yeah, I think it's a lot different than cooking in some sense. I mean, cooking, you're on your feet, you're doing things, but it's a different mental state and physical, for sure.
Well, you've done both. I haven't really done either, so I wouldn't even be able to comment on that. But
yeah, well, the baking side, I think, is more feeling like a vampire at 7 in the morning or 4 in the morning when you see the sun coming up. It's very strange.
Oh, yeah, I would think so.
Is it difficult to describe baking or write about it? Because it's a physical and a manual sort of labor, as well as now. I mean, you really have to know you're crunching the numbers and things.
Well, that's the part that I'm good at, that I really like. I like explaining things. I like figuring things out. That's really, really fun for me. I love the numbers. I was a math person.
Oh, see, I'm not, and for me, it's made me more able to do math now that I've learned the baker's percentage.
Yeah, the baker's percentage is very helpful. I guess that's what makes me want to write about it, because that's the part that's like, I don't know, that's the puzzle part. That's the really fun part.
Uh-huh. Well, how would you explain to somebody who wants to go into baking or it's just started, what's the best way to get into baking or to try at your first bread?
Somebody who wants to work in a bakery or
well, no, just a novice baker. I mean, I'm on some forums and Dan Lepard's website.
Uh-huh.
And I've noticed the last few days there's all these people going, I've never baked before, and it's a sourdough kind of website, although they use, you know, people use yeast, but a lot of us really like to do sourdough bread, so... Everybody's really trying to just jump right into the sourdough.
That's a disaster. Oh, my gosh. I've taught for a long time, and I used to teach sourdough baking classes, and I'd, you know, make it emphatic that you had to be an experienced baker before you started with sourdough.
Uh-huh.
And I'd always get beginners, always. And then I just stopped teaching it because there was no way to prevent this from happening. But I would start with, in my book, I label recipes as being for beginners, but in general, sweetbreads are usually pretty easy. Just pick some easy recipes and have some successes. Don't jump into the sourdoughs for sure. I mean, even pretty experienced bakers can have a lot of trouble with sourdoughs.
Yeah, they're pretty challenging.
They're real challenging. I even go to bakeries where I think they don't know what they're doing with sourdoughs. Even though it's, you know, once you're ready for it, it's definitely the most exciting kind of bread baking.
Right.
I think you need to kind of know what you're doing. But, you know, I guess I would start, I would tell people start with your favorite, you know, if you love rolls or dinner rolls or if you love sweetbreads or if you like, you know, maybe a whole wheat pan bread or a challah, something really easy. Do it a few times and then move on to other recipes.
Right. If you've picked up on baking, if you have some experience and background, how do you say, okay, I'm going to make my own bread? Because I've asked this question to several bakers, and they pretty said, well, it's pretty much just changing numbers and figuring out the percentages and deciding what sort of bread you want to make. How do you go about deciding on a recipe, making it your own?
I actually taught a class in that once, and I thought I could sort of systematize it, and it became so complicated I couldn't really figure out how. I mean, there is a lot of knowledge that goes behind writing a recipe, but that said, start off with the basics. You need, you know, first you need to know baker's percentage,
right,
and you need to understand, you know, simple recipe balancing, such as 100% flour. That's pretty easy.
Yeah.
You know,
hydration.
You're going to think about, you know, what kind of texture you want. Are you looking for like a sweet bread or a challah with a very tight, fine texture? Do you want gigantic holes? So that'll set your hydration.
Uh-huh.
The yeast, you want to think about how long you want it to ferment, what kind of fermentation you want to give it, what kind of final flavor you want. So something a lot of bakers don't think about, but if you have a really special flour for some reason or another, you've gone to a mill, you might not want a real heavy fermentation flavor. You might want a faster fermentation to highlight the wheat flavor and not overwhelm it, you know, with a fermentation flavor.
Right.
So you think about, do you want a pre-ferment using, you know, a sponge or poulish or a biga? Do you want, you know, more acid taste? Or, again, do you want to taste more wheat and have it be a quicker bread with maybe a heavy bake on it? Salt, you usually keep it 2%. Very common to keep it 2%. Sometimes you play with it with a sourdough and just lower it slightly to 1.8%. That's a place to start. You know, with grains, there's some rules about mixing in non-gluten grains. You usually don't want more than 20% of your flour to be non-gluten, so it's another thing to think about. You can add seeds. You can, you know, add soaked grains. You can add fruit. You can add nuts. You can shape it in different ways. There's so many variables, but it's really fun to play with. I mean, that's the fun of baking.
Right.
What's hard is if you start off with an existing recipe and you start to play with it. The best thing I can say is start off with a recipe, whether it's existing or you've just created something from scratch. Only change one variable at a time.
Uh-huh.
That is a very hard thing to do because you want to say, oh, this didn't turn out, and I'm going to change this, this, and this.
Right.
But you will never understand what is really going on unless you only change one variable at a time, only one ingredient, one technique, one oven, you know, just one thing at a time that you're changing.
Uh-huh. Well, I've been to Europe, and I've tried using different flours with recipes that I've done, and I've been considering lately about, I mean, I love rye breads, and I always ask everybody, why isn't rye a more used flour here in the States? And my usual answer that I get from bakers is like, well, people don't know German breads or rye breads. It's a wheat culture here.
It is a wheat culture, and we don't have access to the flours. That's another big problem.
Yeah.
Because rye, you have to use very freshly ground. So it shouldn't be more than a month after after milling. So that's a huge problem.
Uh-huh.
Where are you going to buy the flour?
Yeah.
I, as a home baker, there's certain rye products you just can't buy, period. Still,
you know,
we've gotten so into bread baking. So there's no supply, and I don't know if that controls demand, and if there was more supply, if there would be better demand, because they are really, it's a really different kind of bread. Most people, I think, are used to Italian, French-style breads.
Mm.
I love German bread.
I love
it. It's so good. It's so healthy, too.
Well, I had this Danish baker that I met in Wales, and she made this rye bread with, like, a beer and this other one that was 100% rye. And we were, like, tasting the bread going, God, it's so, like, flavorful, you know? And I keep trying to get people to go, hey, you know, think about rye bread, you know? And it just doesn't fix in their mind, I guess.
No, but really not having the supply of rye flour is a huge problem.
Yeah. Well, I just thought it was strange because now with the price of wheat being so high and the crop being so bad the last few years, it probably should be coming into to order. That should be coming in now soon.
Yeah, that would be good. I know there's a really good rye mill in Minnesota. So, you know, that part of the country has it, Bay State Milling.
Yeah.
They do a lot of rye. But, yeah, you're right. It is very strong tasting bread. It has different texture than people are used to, but it's so good. I love it.
Yeah.
And it's so healthy.
It really is, and you can do really a lot of things with it.
And if you're, you know, people are worried about glycemic index. I mean, this is, you know, this is very low in the glycemic index.
Yeah, and there's so many different kind of flours out there. There's, like, spelt, and I was introduced to this, like, naked barley in Wales that I just
heard.
Hullis
barley.
Yeah.
Hullis barley. I have a recipe for it because I was fascinated with it in The Blessing of Bread.
Uh-huh.
And then the source, it was Arrowhead Mills. They were carrying, they called it bits of barley, and it was a like a chopped hullis barley, which is the correct term,
right.
Not naked hullis. The idea behind that barley, it's really interesting. Barley, normally the hull is attached to the bran layer.
Yeah.
So in order to make it edible, you have to not only take off the hull, but the hull removes the bran, so
right.
That's where pearled barley comes in,
uh-huh.
Where most of that bran layer is scrubbed off.
Uh-huh.
But in a hullis, you don't have that problem of the hull being attached to the bran, and you can have a whole wheat barley.
Right.
And it is grown in Canada and the United States, but a lot of the people who carry it, the places who carry it, don't label it as such. You have to call the mills and ask them what kind of barley they're using. It's It's not easy.
Yeah, I went to a mill in Switzerland, too, and the guy is the only source of, like, spelt milling there in this particular area of Switzerland, because not many millers like to do it, or they don't have the machinery to do it. And it's pretty fascinating to see the process, and he showed me how he was milling the flour and separating the whole thing, chafe and everything.
Huh.
Quite interesting.
I don't know as much about spelt at all. So it has to be milled really differently from wheat?
Well, it has a harder a shell on it. So they have this milling process to take off the husk because it's a lot harder than wheat.
Uh-huh.
So
I think it's an enclosed husk, whereas wheat will just fall out of the husk.
Yeah, no, this one they have to, like, literally crack it off but they don't lose anything. And it's just really amazing that this is, like, the only guy in this small town and really quiet place, beautiful. We went bike riding there, and he showed us around, and I had to get an interpreter for the conversation, but it was great. It was really interesting. We even got to try a spelt beer, which was really a specialty kind of beer that they have in Switzerland.
And I think the spelt is a little, it's sweeter, isn't it, than the wheat?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And it acts differently, though. I mean, I think it absorbs more water than wheat does. So you have to kind of play around with it. I haven't gotten really good at both rye and spelt yet, so
uh-huh.
I'm still trying.
Mm-hmm.
I go into some German forums, and they have really great recipes, but I just haven't figured out all the different rye types because they have such a different system in milling the rye than we do here.
Right, yeah, it's a completely different system.
Traditions in bread, because, you know, you wrote about the Jewish bread bakers. And I found something kind of interesting, which I don't know if it's true. Maybe you could clear it up for us, about bagels,
uh-huh.
Kugelhoffs being, I kind of looked it up on Wikipedia. And those are like three breads that I found were kind of developed from this big battle with the Turks. Everybody says that, you know, kvassels were invented because the Turks were knocking on the gates of Vienna and the bakers, you know, told everybody, oh, the Turks are coming. So they warned everyone. And then the bagel was created for the king of Poland, who came and saved the Viennese from being overrun by the Turks. And the bagel was supposedly from the stirrup of the horse.
Yeah, I'd read that.
Yeah, and then the Kugelhopf is supposedly the turbans that the Turks wore on their heads. So my question kind of is, are we losing the traditions of bread because of the way we bake today? I mean, there's a lot of breads that are, you know, that people don't recognize because they're not, you know, a standard in the repertoire of bakers here. I mean, even in Europe, I think they're losing some sight of the kinds of breads that they used to make.
We're definitely losing a lot. We've lost a lot. With the blessing of bread, it was just felt like sometimes a race against time because World War II, especially, you know, with so many people being murdered,
sure.
A lot of those traditions were just completely lost. Now with everything being mass-produced and there's certain shapes that aren't easy to mass-produce so nobody does them anymore,
uh-huh.
Yeah, we're always losing. It's horrible.
My mother told me about the bakers in her village. It was basically a baker's oven that everybody would use and would make their own bread, and they would bake their own bread for their family in these giant niches. And so I was fascinating about wood-burning stoves and how to do that stuff.
Where is she from?
She's from the southeastern part of France, near Nice, just in the Maritime Alps, just in the north.
Huh.
She was born in the Riviera, but she lived there during the war in this little town with some farmers.
Oh, huh.
Yeah.
And they would make their own breads but use the baker's ovens?
Yeah, they would have one large communal oven and everybody would just bring their own loaf and everybody would bake their own bread and have the giant bread at home.
Yeah, the huge niches that could last for a week or two or until they baked again.
Yeah.
Because we saw when I was on a baking tour, we went to one of those ovens that they had rehabilitated and were using again.
Yeah.
But, you know... That isn't, I don't think, being commonly used anymore.
Right. Well, I saw there's a baker in Canada. He has this, like, micro sort of bakery that he does out in his backyard in Ontario. And so I'm going to go visit him.
Oh.
Because he just bakes in the middle of the winter. I said, God, how do you do that? And he goes, oh, it's pretty cold, but the oven still stays hot.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's dedication.
Definitely.
I mean, I think, you know, you see this progression of bakers where, you know, first they start to bake, then they get into the sourdough, and the next thing is a wood-fired oven.
Yeah.
And that's what everybody, all these home bakers, even professional bakers, there's a wonderful baker here in Atlanta, Alain Barcham, and he has a wood-burning oven at home.
Uh-huh.
But to do it out in the freezing cold,
be a little treacherous, I think.
I think so.
Why do you think small bakeries like in Europe aren't as successful as like the wholesale bakeries that we have here in, you know, big cities or towns?
You mean, what do you mean by that?
Well, like small retail, just a mom and pop kind of bakery, the neighborhood bakeries.
Why don't we have that here?
Yeah, here in the States.
Money.
Yeah.
People want to make more money.
Right.
And the more bread you make, the more money you can make. And
uh-huh.
We figured out how to do it, really, you know, how to.
And why do you think it works in Europe then?
Gosh, that, you know, I guess people are willing. First of all, maybe they're living in socialist countries, so
uh-huh.
more subsidized there.
Right.
Second of all, maybe they aren't as materialistic as we are here. They're willing to work harder for less money. But it's pretty hard to convince somebody to stay small if they have the ability to be bigger because it's just money.
You know, it's interesting about the Jewish bakeries because we used to have a few here in New York, and virtually I think they're all gone.
Yeah.
Why do you think nobody or how can somebody keep those traditions still alive? Because it really seems like even the neighborhoods are going away. So
I know. Yeah. Well, Kosar's is still around, isn't it?
Yeah, that's pretty much the last one. I mean,
Recently
Girdle's closed down. I was like, oh, my God. I think there's only Moishe's, too.
Yeah, and Moishe's. Oh, my gosh. It's such a hard way of life. I guess, you know, maybe the kids aren't willing to
sacrifice.
Yeah, to go into the business anymore.
Right.
You know, we've just maybe gotten really soft as Americans. It's so sad. I hate that.
Yeah. Well, that's what Dan Leder had told me. It was, you know, he said if it wasn't for the guys I have working up there at the bakery in the middle of nowhere, I'd have nobody. He had a professional baker come who was begging him for a job to work, and she only lasted, I think, 6 months. And she said, it's too much. I can't do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I understand. I really understand both sides of it. It's,
yeah.
It is so difficult.
What book are you working on now?
Well, I wish I was working on a book. I keep thinking, you know, I have all these ideas and haven't committed to anything yet. I have to say, and I don't know how much you're talking about this with your other baking friends, but the no-knead breads, just that really captured me, really fascinated me, because I had not kneaded my challahs very much and had kind of stopped kneading altogether. And then this recipe came up, and I've started playing with that a lot, just variations of it. So
you baked it in a Crousette pan?
Yeah, you know, I did it his way. I did it that whole way, and then I kind of thought I've thought about it a lot. Have you tried it?
I have. I even wrote a post about it, and I even interviewed Jim.
Okay.
So it's been an interesting time speaking with him, because I met him years ago at school when I was going to the French Culinary, and a bunch of us were on the Saturday baking class and went down to meet him, and he really put on a Jim Leahy show.
Uh-huh.
So it was pretty interesting.
Okay. Well, I have to say, you know, he figured out something very smart there. He
right.
figured out a way to make really good bread very easily. And the leap that I had never taken was the idea that you don't really need to knead your bread dough, which people have been talking about. I remember interviewing Craig.
Ponsford.
Craig, thank you very much. Craig Ponsford has his ciabatta recipe, and he bragged to me about how he just didn't knead it at all, and it was still lumpy. It still had lumps of flour in it.
Huh.
And I watched him make it, and you know what? There weren't really lumps of flour. Once you put it through a spiral mixer, you're not going to really have too many lumps of flour. But, you know, he had sort of maybe planted that seed, the idea that you don't need to knead very much.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd done it with the challah, but I'd never done it with these kind of artisan breads.
Right.
And I mean, what it basically boils down to at home, I have no idea if this works professionally or not. But forget about this 18-hour rise and all this stuff. I mean, that is just kind of bells and whistles. Don't need to knead a lot.
Yeah.
In fact, you almost don't need to knead at all. And I've been playing with this pizza dough that I don't need at all. So that's something that's been really fun. Now, Jim's writing a book. I definitely would not, there's no way I could scoop him on this. And there's been other people writing about it. But that's something really fascinating. My books have always been how to replicate, you know, professional bakery breads at home, and then I wrote a book, you know, how to replicate these traditional breads at home. So they've been sort of more labor intensive.
Uh-huh.
And I have to think the other way, how to make things easier for home bakers. My focus is on home bakers. You know, just how to keep, there's a lot of complicated things that recipes will have you do that really don't result in anything important in the finished product.
Right.
So that's really interesting to me.
Yeah, well, there's this baker, Dan Lepard in England, who has a sort of similar method. There's a bit of kneading, but it's not intensive. It's like 10-second kneads, and like three times, and then you do, you know, folds in between the resting periods. And I've done his math, and it's really great. I mean, it just, you get really wonderful breads that come out. And I've also, on the other hand, tried like Richard Burtonnet. He does a really classic French thing where you kind of whip the dough down on the board and then turn it and whip it again. And I guess that's a satisfaction thing where you can like beat your dough.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I still can't get the same crumb that you can get in a spiral mixer.
Uh-huh.
There's still just, you know, no way I figured out how to do that at home.
Hmm.
So my attitude was, well, if you can't do it, you know, you can get, what I always think about is the effort you put in versus the results.
Right.
So you can put zero effort in, really, like zero effort, and get really decent results versus putting a lot of effort in to the same recipe. Everything's the same. It's just, I'm just talking about the kneading.
Uh-huh.
And get maybe slightly better results, but for the effort involved, not worth it.
Yeah. Well, I'm called the lazy baker, and I think it was because Steve Sullivan had kind of mentioned, wow, you sound like a lazy baker. And I said, yeah, I am. And it's because I, you know, I don't write notes or really kind of watch what I'm doing. I just kind of go with what I remember they taught me in school, and a little bit of shortcutting here and there. And but this method that Dan Lepard does is great because, you know, it really takes no time at all. I can sit on the computer while the bread's just resting a little bit and give it a turn and then just wait till later. And you do get pretty, you know, nice little crumb in there that's, you know, has great holes and stuff.
What's your hydration on that?
Oh, it all depends. I mean, on my sourdough?
Or whatever.
Equal amounts flour, equal amounts water for the sourdough.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Yeah.
Sourdough.
Yeah.
But no, I'm talking about for the dough, this dough that you're talking about, the one that sits next to your computer.
Oh, well, these are all different doughs that he has in his book, The Homemade Loaf.
Okay.
But it varies on each recipe, really. But I had this guy make a spreadsheet for me for sourdoughs,
uh-huh.
And it's basically tagged to what I do for my sourdough, equal, you know, parts water and flour for my levain.
Uh-huh.
So basically, you can change the hydration to whatever you want just to see if you can, you know, higher or lower. And so I you know, change it around and stuff. But on my website, you can see the pictures. There's definitely some pictures of my loaves there, so you'll be able to. I even did Jim Leahy's loaf.
So what did you think of Jim Leahy's?
He's a really interesting guy.
No, I said Jim Leahy's apostrophe S. Not going to get you to gossip. What did you think of his bread? Bread that he published.
Well, the Pugliese, the one I tried that one, and it just didn't work out. I think it's just because I was lazy and really didn't spend so much time on the detail of how he did it.
Uh-huh.
And I was so used to using like a pizza stone rather than a cruset pan.
Yeah.
So it was okay, but
so you didn't do it in the pan.
Oh, I did do it in the pan. I did in the cruset.
You did, okay.
But then when I was in Switzerland, I did his Pugliese bread, which it was funny because I told him that I'd gotten his recipe for the Pugliese from Martha Stewart's show, and he kind of made a joke about that. And I said, well, I turned it into sourdough. And he goes, oh, really? And so, you know, I went to Switzerland, and my sister was using, like, spelt flour, and I actually made it with spelt, and it worked out pretty well. I mean, it was a little bit runny, but I did it with a no-knead, and it worked out pretty nice, and my sister loved it, so she was happy.
Oh, good.
And I've done it with wheat as well, so it was really nice with the wheat, I think, a little different.
Yeah, I got really good results. My biggest criticism with that recipe is the amount of yeast he uses.
Yeah.
For an 18-hour rise, that's a lot of yeast.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do, my pizza has the same percentage of yeast, and it's
right.
A 6-hour rise.
Uh-huh.
So that thing is like way over.
Really moving.
Really, really over fermented. But, you know, that's a quibbling point, really.
Maybe he's doing it for the people who have no no idea really, because I mean, once I noticed it on the web, all these people writing about it, I said, "What is this?" You know, and I'd seen it in the New York Times, and I finally said, "Okay, I'm going to have to try it and see what happens."
It was interesting. It's really interesting, but the 18-hour rise is so unnecessary for that technique.
Uh huh.
But you can do a 1-hour rise. It doesn't matter. That's not what's building the gluten there.
Oh, and I wonder if maybe you could even retard the dough.
Yeah, you can retard it. Why not?
Yeah, sure.
It's not a time thing. That's not, you know, that the gluten isn't forming because of the amount of time that dough is fermenting.
Uh-huh.
It's just that gluten forms pretty fast.
Yeah, sure.
You know, it's done. That's it.
Especially if you're kneading it.
Yeah, but if you're not kneading it, it's going to form in 5 minutes. So it doesn't matter if you give it 5 minutes or 18 hours. You're still going to have gluten there.
Yeah, because you're giving an initial stir or whatever to...
As soon as the water hits it, yeah. That's all it takes.
Yeah.
It's a chemical reaction. It's really simple.
Well, I just tried a chestnut bread the other day, and I'd gotten the flour from my sister in Switzerland with chestnuts, and then I tried making this thing, and for some reason the chestnuts just made everything move really fast, and I did it with sourdough, and it was just really bizarre. I mean, it tasted really great, very sweet, kind of like honey kind of taste, the dough itself.
Ooh.
It's a pretty interesting flour, so I'm going to try it.
Oh, yeah, chestnut flour is wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not something it's easy to buy here either.
No, you have to go really to Italian places to find something like that, and now there's like fewer and fewer Italian places to find things. So.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you for talking to us.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
It's
and,
fun to talk to another bread geek every once in a while. I don't know what you call yourself, no offense.
Oh, no, it's quite fine. I'm pretty geeky about my bread. Well, I'm certainly hoping that you'll be writing another book soon, because I've got both of them, and so I'm rooting for you.
Good, thank you.
Yeah.
Should I root for you to open a bakery?
Well, I don't know. I'm trying to write a book, too, but I have no idea how to go about it, so I'm still, you know, scratching my head on that one.
That's what I did.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well, I have the website so I can write about things, and then somebody said, well, just use that as your book. I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah, a lot of people are doing that now. It seems like a really good way into publishing.
So hopefully, maybe I'll have one out soon. Then you can interview me.
Yeah. Well, lots of luck to you.
Thanks very much.
All right. Take care.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.